It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. I appreciate y'all turning out here.
All right. I'm going to be speaking to y'all. I'm a participant in the Crime Think Workers or Ex-Workers Collective. We've been publishing for about a quarter of a century, an informal network stretching out around the globe. We're anarchists. We desire to be in a world without hierarchical power, without oppression of any kind. One of the many things that we do is we coordinate dialogue between participants in social movements in different parts of the world. So we arrange to correspond with people who are participating in uprisings or in social movements from here to Hong Kong, Brazil, Russia, Japan, and China. Can y'all hear me all right here? Everything's good? Okay, great. So today, that's what I'm going to be speaking to y'all about. I'm going to be speaking to you summarizing some of the dialogues that we've been having with participants in the recent wave of social movements, which includes the uprisings that are unfolding right now in Hong Kong, in Ecuador and Chile, in Iraq and Lebanon, and elsewhere around the globe. I want to begin with something that a friend of ours was told in Chile. He was interviewing a longtime Chilean anarchist about the uprising that's been going on there for 2 months now, that has faced down the military as well as the police for 2 months, burning barricades, fighting the police, and defending themselves against the force of the state. He was interviewing a longtime Chilean anarchist, and he said, "Were there any mistakes that you want to tell us about that you made in the course of this struggle? Were there any mistakes that you made that you think it would be important to learn from?" And the anarchist that he was interviewing told him, yes, our biggest mistake was that we didn't expect this to happen. It was a mistake not to expect that all of the suppressed social struggles, all of the conflicts in Chile would rise to a boil, and that there would be a movement like this, that there would be an uprising. And what I take from this is that it's important for us to be thinking right now about the movements and the upheavals and the unrest in our future and the kinds of organizing that we need to be doing right now to be prepared for these. I remember in December 2008 in Greece when the police killed a young man, Alexis Grigoropoulos, a 15-year-old, and they killed him in the neighborhood of Exarchia in Greece. Greek anarchists responded by burning and smashing all of the stores in many of the business districts throughout the country. And the nation of Greece was paralyzed by riots for several weeks. This was surprising to us because it seemed like a very quiet situation in most of the world at that time. But in fact, what happened in Greece was a forewarning of the social movements that were to take place, starting with the Tunisian and then Egyptian uprisings in 2010 and 2011, and spreading from there to social movements that occupied plazas in Greece and Spain, and then in the United States with the Occupy movement. The movement in December 2008 in Greece was a forewarning. It was a foreshadowing of the movements that then spread throughout the Arab Spring and to Turkey, Brazil, Bosnia, and many other parts of the world. Today we are seeing a wave of social movements again around the Middle East and South America and the Pacific Rim. And I don't think that this is the high point of a new wave of revolutions or of uprisings. I think actually that this just like the events in December 2008, is a foretaste, a foreshadowing of the struggles that are ahead of us. Because the problems and the conflicts that produced the social movements of 2011 have not been resolved. They have not been concluded in some way. There's no new social contract to resolve those conflicts. And in the years since then, we've seen a new wave of right-wing reaction that has also not changed or resolved the situation. And we are probably going to see another wave of social movements in the next few years. So one of the things that we can do in spaces like this is to discuss how we could be organizing, how we could be preparing, how we can be learning from the things that have happened already. What I'm going to do in the next few minutes is to present some of the hypotheses that we have produced in our dialogues about the movements that are taking place right now, some of the things that we think we can learn from them, and how they might inform the ways that we organize and the ways that we strategize going into the movements that are coming next. What I'm drawing on will be examples of social struggle from around the world, from many of the countries that I've mentioned, but I believe that it's also relevant here in California, even in small-town California. So one of the things that's significant about the social movements that we've seen over the last few years, in contrast to many of the social movements in the 20th century, is we don't see them starting from labor organizing. We don't see them starting from strikes in factories. Once the unrest gets underway, often then labor organizations and unions get involved, and there are strikes or struggles that involve labor. But usually these are beginning somewhere else, in a space of, for example, in response to consumer issues. Like in Lebanon, the movement was triggered by the government trying to impose a tax on the use of WhatsApp phone calls, right? Or in Chile, and then before that in Brazil, there was an uprising triggered by an increase in the cost of subway tickets. These are triggered by consumer issues. I think this is not because labor is an irrelevant issue, but rather because it's become more and more difficult to have leverage in the workplace through strikes and labor organizing. Because in a globalized world, if you organize one workplace, the global economy, the neoliberal global economy, will just reroute the production process or the distribution process around you to some other node in the global assembly line, that the worldwide economy makes up, right? And this creates a situation in which each of us is less and less essential to the process of production. That each of us is less and less essential to the global economy. That we are regarded by global capitalism as being expendable in some way. That we are dispensable. They can throw any subset of the population away and be able to continue with the process of production and consumption. This is something I think that we'll see increasingly in the coming years, is that human life will be treated as more and more cheap in more different parts of the world. And we can see this even with the way that policing has escalated. Police have always disproportionately killed black and brown people, especially black young men. But the amount of police violence that we're seeing, not just against targeted communities, but also in the policing of protest movements, is escalating in many parts of the world. If we look at what's been happening in Hong Kong or in Chile, where people have been in the streets in open conflict with the authorities for months now, in Chile, hundreds of people have lost their eyes to tear gas canisters. Dozens of people have been killed. Many people have been killed in the last several months in the course of these movements. I remember in 2001, at the high point of the so-called anti-globalization movement, when the police murdered Carlo Giuliani during the G8 summit in Genoa in Italy. And all of us knew Carlo Giuliani's name after this. For months, we made sure that everyone heard his name. If we tried to make the names of everyone who has been killed by police known worldwide, that is a long list just over the last few months. So this is one of the frightening things, is that we are regarded as surplus humanity. And the kinds of police control, the kinds of state violence that are being used to suppress us are intensifying. And I don't just mean the violence of them shooting bullets or shooting tear gas canisters. I also mean the the kind of surveillance and control mechanisms that are used. In Iran, in China, we see examples of the kind of intensity of surveillance and invasive control mechanisms that are intended to prevent social movements from arising, intended to prevent us from defending our interests relative to them. But in fact, many of the technologies that are used for this kind of surveillance and control are produced by United States companies. And we're seeing more and more of the same surveillance mechanisms turned against us. The other side of this coin, in a situation where the state is more and more using open violence to try to control us, is that the state itself is not regarded as legitimate or as a positive thing as much as it used to be. That more and more people are resentful of the state, resentful of government, see it as something that exists chiefly to impose violence on the population. And when the state can't mitigate the effects of capitalism on the population, when the state can't maintain some sort of social contract with the workers who produce these profits, the state itself has become a sort of a hot potato. Whoever holds state power is quickly delegitimized in the public eye. Today, politicians are less popular than they ever were before throughout human history, right? Throughout the existing polls that are available to us through the corporate media, the politicians from every party are regarded as unpopular. Whoever is able to present themselves as being against the authorities is able to gain popularity. We saw this under Obama, that the far right was able to gain considerable popularity because they were able to say that they are the ones who are against the existing order. If Hillary Clinton had been elected, I fear that the far-right social movements on a grassroots level would actually be much stronger now because they would be able to present themselves as being rebels. This position of being able to appear to be a rebel is increasingly desirable for everyone. And as the prevailing order fractures, we will probably see more and more components of the ruling order presenting themselves as rebels or trying to say that they are outside and against the reigning order. That's one of the things that I want to talk about today. It also helps us to understand the political strategy of someone like Trump, who is not trying to win over the entire population, who is not trying to be a president that represents everyone. You know, we can't imagine anyone being an FDR, like a Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 2020. A person who would be popular with a vast majority of the population. Instead, Donald Trump is making an effort to appeal to his base, appeal to a plurality rather than a majority of the population, because he sees us going into a situation in which there's not going to be a majority that's united supporting the state power. There's going to be a plurality, perhaps, like a solid groups that are fighting against each other. That it's not going to be a situation in which it's easy for someone to hold state power. I think back to Argentina in 2001, 2002, where the people overthrew 17 governments in a period of a few weeks, right? And when we're in a situation where the state can't resolve our problems, this is going to be a more common situation. The movements that I'm talking about, many of them have been sparked by consumer issues. I mentioned the increase of subway fare in Chile and before that in Brazil as one of the sparks. I mentioned the tax on WhatsApp calls in Lebanon. The increase in taxes on fuel has been another cause of consumer unrest in France, which sparked the Yellow Vest movement, the Gilets Jaunes movement, and also more recently in Ecuador, the new austerity measures that would increase the cost of gas sparked a movement that occupied the state legislature and actually forced the government to cancel the austerity measures. If I talk about these movements, are these mostly familiar to y'all? Okay, great. Y'all have heard about the Gilets Jaunes movement? You follow this in France? Okay, but the other aspect of these, they're not just consumer movements. They're not just movements for consumer rights or something, or, you know, for cheaper gas prices. All of them are movements that in some way challenge the legitimacy of the authorities. Coming out of this situation in which, as I've described, the state is a hot potato. All of these are movements that challenge the right of the state to rule over people. So, and this, they can challenge this in many different ways or on many different, according to many different premises. In much of the former Eastern Bloc, there are movements against corruption, movements saying that the authorities are corrupt in Georgia or in Moldova. Movements that say the reigning orders are corrupt, right? And the problem with this, of course, is that it suggests that if we could just get good politicians into office, that everything would work just fine after all. This is it's related to the Democrats' arguments against Donald Trump, right? They say Donald Trump doesn't respect the rule of law. What would we do then if a Democrat came to power who did respect the rule of law and was carrying out all the same deportations, all the same imprisonment, all of these things, but was doing it legally? Would we then get out of the streets? I would argue that by protesting against corruption, these movements leave the political system a way to re-legitimize itself and to sort of clean its hands and continue carrying out a lot of the same violence. Another example of this is movements that call the authorities into question in the name of national sovereignty. And we can see this in Catalonia, which is calling for independence from Spain. We can see this in Hong Kong, which is calling for more independence from China. It's a way to understand the movement in Rojava as well, that it's supposed to be an autonomous space, basically calling for some form of national sovereignty from the rest of Syria. Now, the problem with movements based around national sovereignty, yes, they call the reigning authorities into question, but in most cases they are basically proposing to replace them with another set of authorities. For people in Barcelona to be governed by Catalan capitalists rather than capitalists based in Madrid would not fundamentally change their situation. For Hong Kong to be independent from China, maybe it would be a smaller police force that was controlling the people, but it is actually the police in Hong Kong who have been oppressing the people there. It's not that they've been busing police from China in. And finally, the other problem with movements based in national sovereignty is, what is it that could keep Hong Kong safe from China? Or what is it that could keep Rojava safe from Turkey? Actually, the only thing that could protect the social movements in these places are social movements on the other side of the border. If there were powerful social movements in China, if there were powerful social movements in Turkey, those would be the only hope for the people in rebellion in Hong Kong and Rojava. So we have to have an internationalist framework or logic or strategy for what we're doing, not just a movement based in national sovereignty that breaks us into different blocks that are turned against each other. The final example of the way that these movements challenge the authorities, but in a way that leaves space for them to re-legitimize them, is in Chile. As I said, in Chile, the social movement, which is basically an anti-capitalist and anti-state movement, has been able to face down the state for 2 months. In order to try to pacify the population and resolve this problem, the Chilean president, Piñera, has proposed that they can rewrite the constitution. He says, we'll have a big process for dialogue, draw everyone into this dialogue, we'll rewrite the constitution and start over, but still with Piñera as the president. Right? They're willing to go to great lengths to re-legitimize the state structures in a way that will basically reproduce the same problems, and we'll have to begin our organizing again under a new constitution, under a new government, you know, but facing the same fundamental problems caused by capitalism and the hierarchical structure of the state. So I'm arguing that we're seeing all of these anarchist critiques sort of displaced or deformed, you know, reappearing as a way to clean the apparatus of the state rather than to replace it. And if we do this, if we, you know, re-legitimize the state, really, it will only give more space for the right wing to be able to say that they are the only actual rebels against the order, that the left was allowed its chance to fix things, and you know, and that things continue as normal. So this brings me to the thing that I really want to speak about today, which is how to conceptualize or strategize our situation when we are not just up against a single adversary, but we are up against multiple adversaries. Right? Because the state isn't a monolithic entity. The state is comprised of centrist or left components and far-right components, some of which are active outside of the apparatus of the state as well. When I was a younger activist in the so-called anti-globalization movement, which I would just call the anti-capitalist movement, we understood ourselves as being in a two-way fight between people and power. Today, I think that we have to understand ourselves as being in a fight that involves at least three sides. As an anarchist, if I had to define what those three sides are, I would say basically they are, first, the neoliberal state as it exists, you know, and all who want to fix it, all who want to make it work better. Some of them are on the right, neoconservatives, you know. Others are on the left, like Bernie Sanders or the party Syriza in Greece. They have a proposal, they have an idea for how to make neoliberalism work better. They want to make it work in the interests of many different people. But because they all share the neoliberal state as their basic model, they're all like in one category. The second category is nationalists who are ready to break with the neoliberal model in favor of some sort of model of civil war. They are not trying to work everything out for everybody under a single model of governance. They have a particular category of people that they're trying to advance the interests of at everybody else's expense. Now, this could be defined along lines of citizenship. It could be defined along lines of race. It could be defined along lines of religion. A way to understand ISIS is that they are a nationalist religious entity. But all of these are groups that have a vision of the future that involves like warring ethno-states or warring nationalist projects. This is not the same as stabilizing the neoliberal order in a way that will be in everyone's interest. And finally, the third category that I would define is autonomous and anarchist movements, social movements that are based in grassroots organizing for social change that isn't supposed to pass through the state. This is the third category. Now, to be fair, all of the social struggles we see, there's usually multiple elements involved in each group, right? So Trump's government involves people who are trying to make neoliberalism work better, and it involves people who are just hardcore nationalists like Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon. And in the same way, a lot of the social movements we participate in have somebody in them who would like to get into office, you know, and then other people who really believe in grassroots organizing. But I think that we will be able to see things more clearly in the movements that we're involved in if we understand ourselves as being in struggles that involve at least three sides. I'll give a couple examples of what I'm talking about here. I talked earlier about the Egyptian Revolution of 2011. The Egyptian Revolution in 2011 took place because there was a social movement against the neoliberal government of Mubarak. The social movement was able to succeed in part because participants in the social movement were able to ally in some way with Islamic fundamentalists from the Muslim Brotherhood. And together, these two forces were able to overthrow Mubarak's government. As a result of this, Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood became the next head of state in Egypt. And of course, you know, as I described earlier, the problems continued, right? The same problems of living under an oppressive state with a violent police force under capitalism continued, and people had to go back out in the streets again and again continue to organize against the government under Morsi. And after 2 years, in 2013, the social movements that had been continuing to fight against Morsi in this three-way struggle allied themselves, this time in some way allied with the military, which overthrew Morsi and installed al-Sisi, who is still the de facto strongman, or you could say dictator of Egypt up to today, who is looking for, you know, who's looking into ways to establish himself as the head of state in Egypt for decades to come, right? This is an example of how thinking, you know, of the struggles that we're in as two-sided will make us miss the fundamental strategic questions. Once the social movements allied with the military, they created a situation in which Sisi was able to come to power and consolidate his power and legitimacy in such a way that he could not be deposed. We can also look at the social movement in France over the last, I guess, now more than a year, the Gilets Jaunes movement, which in taking on the centrist government of Emmanuel Macron, involved people from the far left and the far right. So you have fascists, anarchists, communists, nationalists, all in the streets together, fighting against the police and often against each other. In a situation like this, if we only understand ourselves as trying to fight against the government, we don't understand the potential governments in waiting next to us in the streets, we put ourselves in a very vulnerable situation. So what I want to do with the rest of my time here is to set forth some proposals for strategic principles that we can bear in mind when we are in three-way struggles, when we are in fights both against the reigning neoliberal authorities and against the nationalists who would like to replace them and become the next government. And I believe these are relevant. They're relevant in Hong Kong, they're relevant in Lebanon, they're relevant in Chile right now, but I also think they're relevant in the United States. If you've been involved in anti-fascist struggles here, is anybody here done anti-fascist organizing? No one in this space? You have, yeah. Probably somebody has, right? If you've been involved in anti-fascist organizing, you've probably had the experience where you are struggling both against the fascists and against the local government that would, you know, that would like to suppress the fascists for you in a way that would also involve suppressing you, right? And when you're fighting against fascists, you have to do so in a way that doesn't also legitimize the struggles of the centrists who would like to have power over everything. Okay, so I'm going to go through and propose some principles that we can bear in mind for these situations. First proposal, in a three-way fight, one of the things that is at stake is what it means to fight, what it means to fight itself. To put this in a slogan, the struggle in the struggle is the struggle. These are struggles to define what it means to be struggling today. When the far-right nationalists and fascists were in the streets next to anarchists and autonomists in France against the French government, they were fighting to define what struggle against the government should look like. Each of them was trying to set an example or set a model for what struggle looks like. And in this, in the course of this, they were just, it was not just that the government was their enemy, but that they were enemies for each other, right? In this situation, we have to transcend false binaries. Is it because one of the ways that our adversaries benefit from each other is they say, well, if you don't like Trump, then your only hope is to elect Biden, or somebody else like that. Your only hope is the Democratic Party. These false binaries reproduce the existing order. And another example is Donald Trump and the far-right nationalists in this country actually have benefited quite a bit from fundamentalist Islam, right? It's hard to understand what George Bush was trying to do in Iraq if you don't bear this in mind, that the Republicans have benefited very much from being able to say to Americans, we are the only thing between you and these terrorists overseas. They say that while at the same time intensifying the conditions that produce Muslim extremism, right? They create a situation where, they want to create a situation where we're forced to choose between one or the other. And our job in this situation is to advance a third option, an option that it transcends the conflict that they are producing and that refuses to accept the leadership or the legitimacy of either of them. In this situation, we can try to clarify the stakes of these fights. We can try to clarify the terms of the struggles that are taking place. Rather than reinforcing one or the other of these loyal oppositions. Second proposal. In the situation that I'm describing, in which we are seeing a series of three-way fights around the world, the kind of activity, the kind of protest tactics that we have employed as anarchists don't necessarily identify people as our allies, don't necessarily identify people as having the same values or visions or goals as we do. In France, during the Gilets Jaunes movement, you could see fascists claiming credit for attacks on police. Pictures of fascists fighting police saying, our boys, these fascists, are the ones who are fighting against the forces of order. We can imagine fascist barricades. We can imagine fascists smashing windows. We can imagine fascists appropriating many of the tactics that we have developed. So we should not assume that our tactics can speak for us. We have to make our visions clear. We have to make our proposals for another way of being in the world clear. We have to always connect the tactics that we use to the vision of the world that we want to be in. And if we don't do this, if we don't succeed in doing this, we will see our tactics exploited and appropriated by our adversaries. third proposal. In a situation in which struggle is inevitable, in which there's nothing the government can do to satisfy people, it will be advantageous to take the initiative, to be the ones to, at the beginning and at the front of these struggles. Because when we are the ones initiating the struggles, we can contribute to setting the terms of those struggles. We can contribute to setting the discourse or the dialogue about what it is that's at stake. When fascists are the ones who initiate a struggle, as you know, they participate in initiating the Gilets Jaunes movement in France, they could say, yeah, this is a movement, we want to have affordable gasoline or something. You know, we want French citizens to be more, you know, looked out for by the government. We want less immigration or something. They were able to make those demands at the beginning of that movement because they were there from the beginning. This makes it very important for us to be there at the beginning of the movement, making counterproposals or fighting against them. If there are conditions that make it possible to organize a movement, if there's a lot of discontent, that makes it very important for us to be organizing immediately to try to be the ones setting the terms of the struggles. The other side of this is that when we are the ones who stick our necks out, that means more risk for us, right? That means more endangerment for us. And that can create a situation where if we take all of the risks to get a movement off the ground and then we sustain all the repression as a consequence of that, then we have to be careful to make sure that other groups with different agendas can't swoop in and take all the credit for themselves, as has often happened in struggles. That brings me to the fourth proposal that we want to make coming out of our dialogues about the struggles around the world today. That proposal is that we have to enter each of these struggles with the goal of fighting in a way that makes us stronger. Often when you enter a fight, that fight is draining for you. You come out of the fight with fewer resources. You come out of the fight exhausted or injured or with your relationships broken down. In a situation where we're not just fighting against one adversary, but we will have to fight a succession of adversaries, it becomes very important to fight in a way that actually gives us more momentum, that gives us more connections with people. And we should evaluate the effectiveness of our strategies and the effectiveness of our organizing, the effectiveness of our conflicts by how they connect us to more people. So, for example, in a movement where you are struggling against fascists, you have to be sure that you come out of that movement with more people participating in your structures rather than less. In Russia, anti-fascist comrades of mine there who fought against fascists for years, finally, the problem with fascism became widely understood in Russia as a result of their efforts. And as a result of this, the government finally cracked down on fascists very hard, destroyed the different fascist organizations. And having destroyed the fascist organizations, the government forces continued that repression, targeting anti-fascists. And continued cracking down until they had destroyed most of the anti-fascist structures as well. This is a risk for us, right? We have to fight in ways that draw more people to us, that make us more prepared for the struggles that will come afterwards. And that relates to my next point, which is that when we are framing the terms, when we are explaining to the general public why it is that we're taking on an adversary, like a fascist group or a neoliberal government, we have to be sure that we present our argument in a way that doesn't give another side a way to say that they are the ones who can solve the problem. We say the problem with fascists is that they're out there recruiting, that they have too much free speech or something, you know. The government will say, well, we're actually the ones who can prevent them from recruiting. We have to show that both of our adversaries are the problem. The anti-Confederate and anti-fascist, anti-racist organizers in the small southern town that I come from have been doing this in a really intelligent way. There's been a long struggle against Confederates, against a Confederate monument, against various forms of like racist organizing, white supremacist organizing. That's been taking place in the center of the town where there's a university. They've been very strategic and intelligent that every time they fight against the Confederates, they always make a point in their discourse of showing how the university and the town government, which are like liberals, are at fault for this struggle having to take place in the first place. You know, they always make a point of directing the critique not just against the Confederates, but against the other set of authorities in question. Another argument that we want to make coming out of our dialogues about this is that in three-sided conflicts, alliances are dangerous, especially for the weaker party. I was talking about what happened to the social movement in Egypt when they allied first with the Muslim Brotherhood and the militant Islam, and then when they allied against the military and the neoliberal state. In these situations, it's very easy to help one of your adversaries to defeat the other and then to defeat you. Right? If you want to learn more about the story of what happened in Egypt, I can recommend a website that has a bunch of accounts from participants in the Egyptian revolution from 2011 to 2013. But there are many other examples of this throughout history. It's a way to understand what happened in the Russian Revolution from 1917 to 1921, that anarchists and others in the social movement helped the Bolsheviks to defeat the democratic government, and then the Bolsheviks were able to defeat them. This is the same thing that happened during the Spanish Civil War in 1936 to 1939, that anarchists, who in fact were the majority of the participants in the Spanish Civil War in many parts of the country, helped the pro-Soviet, pro-Stalinist communists in the struggle against the fascists, and then ultimately were betrayed by them, as Orwell wrote about in Homage to Catalonia. It shows for us the risk of alliances. And I would say that the solution to this is not that we should never ally with anyone. The solution is that we should seek connection not with the leadership of some other movement in our society, but that we need to be seeking connection with the rank and file. That we need to seek connection with the other ordinary people like us, but always be suspicious of their leadership. Always be strategizing so that we are against both centrist, liberals, and fascists and nationalists. I'm coming to the end here. I want to make two more arguments. First, in struggles like this, in struggles in which we are up against more than one adversary, I want to say a loss in a social movement or a social struggle, it can set us back months or years, but the wrong victory can set us back decades. If somebody comes to power who is able to present themselves as a part of the left or as representing the same agenda that we are pursuing, but in fact, because the state can't solve these problems now, fails to do the things that they promised, this can create a situation in which it will be a long time before we can organize effectively. We've seen this in Greece, where Syriza was elected and failed to do all the things that they promised, and now a far-right government has been elected and is cracking down on anarchists with impunity. We saw the same thing happen in Brazil under the Workers' Party, the PT, where again, now we have a far-right government there from Jair Bolsonaro. We've seen many examples of this around the world. And for me, the most concrete example is if you look at the parts of the world that used to be part of the Soviet bloc, there actually is less left organizing there today than there is in the places where state socialism never came to power. So, for example, in Greece, which was under a military dictatorship from the 1960s until 1974, there's still a very powerful anarchist movement, despite all the repression that's been directed against people. But if we go a little bit north of Greece into former Yugoslavia, it's very hard for anarchists, autonomous, and anti-state leftists to organize there because people are so disappointed still with the results of Yugoslavian state socialism. This is an instructive lesson for us, I think, especially in a year when many people are going to be talking about voting as a kind of harm reduction. If the state can't actually address these problems, then what actually would achieve harm reduction besides more effective horizontal organizing? There's another corollary of this point for me, which is that even in a situation where we can overthrow a government, we shouldn't think that this will solve the problem by itself. At the beginning, I spoke about the movement in Argentina that overthrew like 17 governments in a period of weeks back in 2001, 2002. Argentina is still laboring under neoliberal democracy today, is still in this situation where they're integrating neoliberal capitalism. At some point when people in France were fighting really hard and thought that they might be able to topple Macron's government, some of us were really concerned about this because the most popular politician after Macron was Le Pen on the far right, right? We were saying, what happens if you defeat Macron and Le Pen comes to power? Like what happened in Egypt when Morsi was defeated and Al-Sisi came to power. It's very dangerous to overthrow a single government without actually bringing about the object of our struggles, which is, you know, a more horizontal distribution of power. I would say don't overthrow one government unless you're prepared to overthrow the next one. A weak government that's widely perceived as illegitimate and that is not able to carry out repression is actually better to be organizing under than a new government that's perceived as having a mandate from the social movement and the, you know, the general population has had a catharsis and gotten all of its rage out of its system and everyone goes home, like happened in Egypt in 2013. Well, everyone went home except for the thousands of people who were in prison, right? Okay, and this brings me to my last point about organizing in a context in which we are facing more than one adversary, in which we're facing both the neoliberal centrists, whether they call themselves left or right, and also nationalists, including some who call themselves anti-state. In a situation like this, the most fundamental thing that we can aspire to do is to show what all of our adversaries have in common and show what distinguishes us from them. Show what they have in common and show how we are different. So, for example, when we're trying to figure out how to organize against both the sort of neoliberal centrist model represented by Biden and the far-right nationalist model represented by Trump, what do they both have in common? You know, they both have in common the state. They will both carry out deportations by the million. They will both keep millions of people in prison. As anarchists, we represent a totally different model, right? And in fact, fascists, nationalists, neoliberal leftists, you know, all of these different groups have in common the fundamental apparatus of repression, which they hope to retain. And we represent a fundamentally different model. In every struggle, we have to figure out how to show to everybody else what our adversaries have in common, that they're not actually, they don't represent a binary choice, but that they represent something that is fundamentally similar and that we are offering something that is meaningfully different. Okay. That is my summary of a lot of conversations that we've had, and I hope that's useful to y'all. I'd love to have a conversation with y'all about how this relates to movements that you're involved in, or if you have any questions about any of the movements that I've been speaking about. Thank you.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.